The fourth presentation is always hard, so if everybody wants to stand up and have a little stretch, take a breath, I'll donate one minute to a little stress reduction. Shake it out a little bit. All right. Okay. The authors have no relationships to disclose. And what I want to talk to you about today is kind of the background and context of some work we're doing to foster healthy child development at our health center. We conducted a survey, a small sample, just to identify stressors and strengths among caregivers of young children receiving care at our health center. And I'll talk a little bit about kind of the implications for doing this kind of screening more systematically. So there's this term that's been coined, toxic stress. Has anybody heard this term? It's sort of hot lately, a few people. So a little background on that. In 2000, the National Research Council and the Institute of Medicine published a report called Neurons to Neighborhoods. And this also was a collaboration with somebody named Jack Shonkoff at the Harvard Center on the Developing Child. And it really addressed and tried to integrate at that time the latest science of early child development, especially in terms of the environment that children grow up in, and especially in vulnerable populations. And so since then, the Harvard Center has continued to kind of consolidate and package and put out this, disseminate this information to advocate for education, healthcare, government policy, and practice to improve early childhood outcomes. And so they came up with this term, toxic stress, which sounds really bad. There's no such thing really as toxic stress, except if it's toxic and it's stress, we know it's bad, and if it has to do with early childhood development, we know it's urgent. It needs to be addressed urgently. And so the definition is excessive or prolonged activation of the stress response systems, very importantly, in the absence of the buffering protection of stable responsive relationships. And so in that context, the developing brain architecture is disrupted. Learning, memory, executive function, social-emotional development, self-regulation is impaired. The threshold for stress reactivity is lowered, disrupts development of the immune system. And there's a lot of research, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Survey, showing that these kinds of adverse experiences can really have lifelong effects in terms of educational attainment, economic productivity, health behaviors, risk behaviors, health status, and even longevity. So this is what it can look like, especially in vulnerable populations. And we've heard in other presentations that's really the population served by community health centers, an environment of poverty, substandard housing, poor nutrition, parents who haven't had proper parenting and know little about parenting themselves, family and neighborhood violence, a myriad of potential stressors. But what's not shown in this picture is the caregiver, which is typically the mother, who could provide that stable, responsive, protective relationship, provided, of course, that she has her own buffer. So this is the healthography of New York City. We're very lucky. Our Department of Health and also our Department of City Planning provides a lot of data and information about local neighborhoods. And so what you're seeing is a map. There are tons of maps, atlases of maps, and the circled area is the South Bronx, where our health center is located. And you'll see that in each map, that area is the darkest. The highest prevalence, poverty, depression, asthma, diabetes, obesity, these are very common. But really, almost every health indicator that is a high prevalence area. And so really, if you overlay these maps, you see that there's a lot of commonality, really with poverty being the underlying factor. So this is where our health center is situated. We have multiple programs, but we have two health centers. We're misnamed community pediatric programs. We have one center in the upper corner is our adult center. Our Center for Child Health and Resiliency is opened a few years ago. Unfortunately, there's a road running through the clinic. You can see these are some more just demographics about the neighborhood. Very high poverty rates, low educational attainment, about 70% Hispanic, a large proportion foreign-born, and also a large proportion who are young. And we see, we're a fairly small program, we see 7,000 patients at our community health centers, but about a quarter of them are pregnant women and young children. So in this context, the grand question, why we're here, what is the community health center to do, and how do we translate this science into practice? So there are a lot of grants now on the state level, private grants to address these kinds of issues, but there really is no roadmap about how to do that. So what does a community health center do? We do a needs assessment. So we developed an instrument to kind of see what we would find. We had some assumptions about that, but we wanted to really quantify what these stressors and strengths are in our population to inform program development and, very importantly, to figure out what kind of resources we would need. So we conducted a waiting room survey. Our target sample was 200, which is small, but if anybody's ever conducted a waiting room survey, it takes a fair amount of time and effort. It was self-administered in English and Spanish, and it was our target population of pregnant women and caregivers, including fathers, of children under the age of 6. So we wanted to see what is the prevalence of risk and protective factors. We especially wanted to focus on the protective factors. As Valerie mentioned, often they are overlooked. And to try to figure out what's the relationship between these stressors and risk factors and mental health systems symptoms, which we know are highly prevalent in this population. So a lot of this is just descriptive, and then there's some exploratory logistic regression analysis. So this is what we did. We measured demographics, a very long list of potential stressors, which you'll see some of which in a little bit, perceived stress, something called the PHQ-4, which these are all validated instruments that are widely used. The PHQ-4 is two items to determine symptoms suggestive of depression, and the GAD is two items suggested of anxiety. So these are not diagnostic, they're initial screens, but they're suggestive and they require further follow-up. We used an 8-item subscale of something called the Health Promoting Lifestyle Profile on stress management and self-care techniques that we've used quite a bit in the past, and 3 items about social support. So this was the demographics, mostly female, mostly English-speaking. The race and ethnicity was very similar to the neighborhood and to what we find generally in this population. Mostly were mothers. We did our best to get the survey completed by fathers, but mostly it was moms. Some guardians and grandparents. So this was the breakdown of just how many children live in the households. You'll see about 20% lived in a household with 4 or more children. About 30% lived in a household with 2 or more children under 6. So we wondered if that might have an effect, which it didn't so much, but that could also, you know, be a factor in overcrowding and you know, other stressful situations. So we also look at social support. So how many people can you depend on when you need help? And strikingly, about a third said they had only one person or no one to depend on. So that's a really high risk, having a social network. If you imagine, 3, I believe, is the magic number. So you have a stool with 3 legs, and you knock out one leg, and the stool falls over. So that is definitely a risk. And then we asked, who are the people that you can depend on when you need help? And primarily, it was respondent's mother. And interestingly, only about 40% said the baby's father was someone that they could depend on. And interestingly, since we did this, have been using a shortened questionnaire in routine prenatal care. And that percentage is quite a bit higher when women are pregnant. So I won't make a huge leap, but it's interesting that, you know, during pregnancy we found that percentage was surprisingly high and seems to drop off later when the children are young. So these were sort of the most frequent stressors. The question was, did you experience any of these, which of these things did you experience in the past year? And I'm showing you just the ones that were greater than 10%. And as you would expect, the top ones, financial problems, unemployment, interestingly, conflict with spouse, health problems, and you can see down the line, housing, neighborhood safety, food insecurity. I'd like you to make a mental note of this order. Okay. So, you know, this is a pretty substantial list of a lot of things that people might be dealing with, and the vast majority of people were dealing with several of these issues. So more than 50% reported at least 3, and the mean also was a little bit over 3. So then we looked at what is the frequency of what I'll call emotional distress. So having a PHQ score greater than 1. I would say that one problem with this measure is that for the PHQ-2 and the GED-2, it's a yes-no question. I experienced 2 questions of a longer screen, the first 2 questions, and if you answer yes on either of those questions, it's considered positive and warrants further evaluation. So I'd say one caveat about this is that these were using yes-no responses, and so if someone endorsed any one of those 4 questions, then it was considered positive. So almost half had symptoms suggestive of depression and or anxiety, and we've actually found that in general, using the screen in kind of different settings at the clinic. About 35% scored positive on the depression screen, about 40% on the anxiety screen, and about a quarter both. So we wanted to look at the relationship between the individual stressors and these mental health issues, symptoms. And so what's interesting about this is, is that all of these have a significant relationship. So these are odds ratios. It increased the risk of having a positive anxiety or depression screen. But what's interesting is that the kind of financial issues, health problems, unemployment that were the most prevalent are really not, don't really confer the greatest risk. What confers greater risk at the other end of the slide, domestic violence, legal problems, conflict among siblings, conflict with spouse. It's interesting sort of what's happening at home. seems to have a greater effect. And that's not to say that all of these things are not very important, but we were just trying to tease out which of the things were kind of the most salient. So we did some exploratory regression analysis, taking those stressors that were significant, doing stepwise logistic regression to see, just for the stressor block, to see what would remain significant. And you can see, again, domestic violence, conflict with spouse, conflict with siblings remain significant. Legal problems and food insecurity are kind of just trending. Number of stressors, number of people to depend on, use of this higher score on the stress management subscale, and satisfaction with social support were all significantly related to having symptoms of depression and anxiety. But the number of stressors and, interestingly, managing stress remains significant. Okay, so here's, never like to use the word final, but here's the final model. Interestingly, none of the demographic factors had any relationship, and I think it's just because it's very, there just is not enough variation for it to show anything. So this was an attempt to kind of feed in kind of all those factors that remain significant. And the three things that emerge are, once again, conflict with spouse, just the number of stressors, so just the degree of things that people are dealing with. And as a longtime stress management instructor, I was surprised that this stress management score had a significant protective effect. And once again, this is not to say, you know, very often when you're doing a regression analysis, you want to pull out, you know, what's important and what's less or not important. So what I would say with this analysis is not that, again, that you would not address other important issues, but I think it really shines the light on what's happening at home and in terms of a community health center and a place where women and children and families have regular contact with care and with mental health services, that there's a lot of potential to foster these strengths. So last slide. So we were able to streamline our survey, which we're now using in clinical care. We give it to all our prenatal patients, and we've started giving it at 6 months and 18 months in pediatric care. Again, I think this the data just shines the light on the social determinants of health in terms of that buffer, going back to the picture of the baby, the resources that the mother might need to be that responsive buffer. And one of the things that we focused a lot on in our programs is group primary care. So group prenatal care, group well-baby care, which instead of having a 15-minute visit, which ends up being a lot about risk assessment or anticipatory guidance, that it really becomes more an opportunity to foster relationships, teach parenting, coping skills, and build supportive networks. Obviously, addressing the poverty-related and financial stability issues are a little bit trickier. And I would say in terms of, you know, resources, it's a matter of having the resources to administer such a thing, talking about, you know, the ability of providers who are already extremely stretched to add an extra screen, and also having on-site mental health and case management services to really address these issues and direct people to care. So my final point is community health centers, really the original patient-centered medical home, have been for a long time before that term was even coined, are really uniquely and ideally situated to address these kinds of issues. Okay, thank you.